everybody. My name is Dot Thompson. I am an addict and a member of Cocaine Anonymous. Hey. Hi, everybody. Let me first thank the Denver Convention Committee for inviting me here. This was a great honor. And when Aaron called me up that day to say, "You have been invited to speak. Can you do it?" I mean, it was like, wow, me? You know? He then said, when I said, "Oh, this is such a great place. Yeah, I would love to do it." He says, "But by the way, are you a member of Cocaine Anonymous?" Thank God I was. Now, let me tell you something. I talk kind of fast. And, oh, you're a new one. So you may have to work a little bit harder with me because I get real excited about sobriety, y'all. Real excited about this thing called sobriety here. And I remember one night I had gone to a meeting and I had shared. And after the meeting was over, this guy comes up to me, he's hugging me, he's shaking my hand. He says, "You know, Dot, I know God must really be speaking through you." My ego just went all the way sky high, you know. I thought undoubtedly I said something very profound in here. I'm smiling. "Okay, well, what did I say that made you think this?" He said, "Oh, it wasn't anything that you said. But under your own power, you couldn't possibly talk that fast." So I'm going to try to slow down tonight. However, if I get too fast, for you especially, just give me some kind of sign. Okay. All right. They say we're supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I think I'll start to the fact that I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah, Memphis in the house, right? I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and I grew up in that part of the part of the country that was into segregation real heavy when I was growing up as a child. And you know, I don't remember a whole lot about that part of my life. To this day, I have not been able to recollect some of those memories from years past in my childhood. There's still this blank. You know, have no recollection of what went on at some of those times. However, there are certain things that I do remember. There was one thing that I always remember, and that's the fact that I never felt quite like I belonged anywhere. You know, I always felt like I wasn't good enough. You know, and I don't know how that came about, but I remember feeling that all the time. There were some certain things that happened during that period of my life that probably attributed to my not feeling like I was good enough. However, I grew up always feeling that I was just not good enough for some reason. You know, so consequently, not feeling I was good enough inside, I became an overachiever. I was very smart in school because I had to be good somewhere because I wasn't good enough just inside myself. I remember one of the things I remember very vividly. I think I was about 6 years old, and there was a store in Memphis called Goldsmith's, one of these really big, you know, expensive department stores. Very good. Whoever said that. And my mom had taken me, we went shopping for Easter, and of course we were the kind of family that didn't have a lot of money, so we went shopping the day before Easter, okay, you know what I mean? So we went shopping that Saturday, and we found this beautiful Easter bunny that I really wanted. I mean, it was like to die for, okay? And I said, "Mama, let me try this on." She says, "No, baby, you can't try it on." I said, "Why not?" She said, "Because you're colored, and they don't let colored people try on clothes in this store." And I felt again, I must not be good enough. However, we got home, the Easter bunny was too small. Easter Sunday came, I had no Easter bunny to wear. And I remember that for years and years after that incident happened. I never felt like I was good enough to do anything. I'm not really sure when I really believe I was born addicted. I believe this with all my heart. Because my parents tell this funny story about when I was 6 months old. My mama left me on the kitchen floor to go to the front door, and she was gone for a while. When she came back, I was gone. She couldn't find me any place. She looked all around everywhere. It finally ended up calling the police because like 3 hours had passed, and they couldn't find me anywhere. So they thought somebody either kidnapped me. I'm 6 months old on the floor crawling. And when they found me, they say I had crawled down 5 wooden steps, had crawled all the way to the garden, and I was laying on my stomach eating raw green beans. Now, they thought it was cute. Today, I look back on it and said, that was very addictive, because today I love green beans, okay? Cannot get enough of them. Now, again, they thought that was cute. But see, today I realized that was very addictive behavior on my part, even at 6 months old. Now, my first introduction to drugs came about at the age of 13, I think. I was about 13. And by the way, y'all, I grew up as a fat kid, okay? I was born at 13 and a half pounds and never lost a pound, okay? So, when I turned 13, my mom thought, you're too fat. You really need to go lose some weight. So she took me to a doctor and they got me diet pills. My first taking of the diet pills, oh my God, y'all, it was the best feeling I ever had in my life. You know, it made me want to run around the house, okay? You know what I mean? I thought, oh God, this is great. I kept on taking them, okay? But I figured out that by 3 o'clock that afternoon, I was starting to come down, and I didn't like the way that felt. Because when I took one in the morning, I was good enough. But by 3 o'clock, you know, that shit was wearing off, you know? So I could take another. So pretty soon, y'all, my 30-day supply was not lasting 30 days, okay? And I remember this being the first of my starting to lie and cheat to get my drugs. At 13, I didn't have no clue I was a drug addict, okay? No clue. But at 13, I started going to different doctors, okay? You know, I had about 5 doctors I was going to getting the pills just so I could keep my habit going, you know what I mean? Now, the other people in the neighborhood, some of the guys in the neighborhood were paying me to do this. So I could keep my little stuff going and sell them the rest of them, you know? So, but they were paying for me to go to the doctor and everything, okay? So this went on for a while, and it was cool. But I wasn't losing no weight, y'all. I mean, high as a kite every day and still fat, okay? So mama finally decided, well, this ain't working, baby, so we're gonna stop you on these now. So she did. Now, undoubtedly, at that time in my life, it was such a time that I could go up without having any repercussions behind it. I stopped doing diet pills. However, you see, in the meantime, I started drinking. I remember the first time I ever drank, it was like one night, one of the guys in the neighborhood bought a pint of vodka, and we all drank, about 3 of us. We drank a whole pint of vodka. My God, y'all, I got sick as a dog, okay? You know, I drank alcoholically the first time that I had a drink, okay? I got sick, throwing up, and I knew it was the vodka. I swore up and down I'd never drink another vodka again in my life, and I didn't. I started drinking scotch, okay? So, I missed a point here. Let me go back a little bit. When I was about 8 years old, my older brother, who was about 6 years older than I, started sexually molesting me and my sister. And I knew it wasn't right some kind of way, but he told me if I told mama that he would beat me up and all this kind of stuff, okay? So this had gone on for like 3 or 4 years now. One of these nights, I remember hiding in closets to keep him from messing with me, you know. I go, if he'd come home drunk. See, I didn't really realize he was an alcoholic. See, I didn't have a clue what the word meant. But I knew he always smelled like gin. I thought gin smelled good, you know. He always smelled like gin, and he'd come home at night, and he drank a lot. He lost a lot of jobs because of his drinking. But I didn't have any idea that he was an alcoholic until I got to these rooms. That's when I found out that he was an alcoholic. Anyway, he had started sexually molesting my sister and I remember nights when he'd come home and he would get my sister's face, I hide in the closet and wait till somebody else came home. It was dark in the closet. And do you guys realize that I had been in this program 6 years before I realized I was afraid of the dark and why? It was amazing. You know, this program has taught me so much about why I react the way I react today in my own life, you know. Anyway, I remember about, now I started drinking scotch by this time and still taking the diet pills, okay? And one night I had taken my diet pills and had gone out and started drinking some scotch that night. And I had just enough mix of the scotch and the diet pills to make me feel very powerful. So I go home this night, and my brother comes in drunk, and he's trying to mess with me. And I said to him, and meant every word of it, that if he ever touched me again, I was going to kill him. Meant every word of it. Now, from that day forward, he never messed with me again. Now, in my 13-year-old head, that meant, this is powerful stuff. You know, this scotch got something going on, you know. So, life went on. He stopped messing with me. However, I carried a machete in my car about this long because I was going to kill him, y'all. I swear it was, okay? I hated his guts. Hated every part of his body. I hated him. But life went on. I went all the way through high school, and for the life of me, don't know how I made it through college, but I did. Doing, of course, diet pills. You have to do diet pills in college to stay up and study, you know what I mean? That's the requirement. So I went on through school doing diet pills. And still drinking. Not knowing that I had a problem. You know, it's amazing, when I got to these rooms, I still didn't know I had a problem, y'all, okay? I thought I was one of those good old alcoholics who could put away a lot of alcohol. It never dawned on me that any person who can drink a fifth of cognac in one setting and not be drunk had a problem. It never dawned on me. You know, I could have been the Dallas Cowboys and it never dawned on me I had a problem, you know? So I go through high school, go through college, and then comes the 60s and I became a hippie. Yes, indeed. I was a flower child, y'all. I used to look like Billie Holiday. I wear flowers all in my head everywhere, okay? You know, loved to ride Volkswagen Beetles. They were great, you know. Lord, and some of the acid they had, you know, the purple haze and all that stuff. Oh, my God, you know. Never felt like I was not less than anybody ever again in life, okay? That stuff was good, y'all. I swear it was. I went through the 60s and I went through the 70s and of course the drugs started to change. I went from the acid to marijuana to, I never did heroin, that's the only thing I never did. The only thing I never did was the downers, okay? I liked being high, okay? I didn't want nothing that's gonna make me sleep. I wanted to be high, you know? Anyway, I go through life and when I did my fourth step inventory, one of the things that I realized was that all my life, I had been dating drug dealers and drug addicts my whole life. That's all I ever had. If I ever met someone who was not drinking or drugging, I thought they were dull. I didn't want to be bothered with them, you know? So consequently, I mean, they say the first one is always free, and it is. Y'all know the first time somebody offers you anything is free. Here, try this, you know? And you take it, and before you know it, you're hooked, you want some more. They're going to go out and spend your own money then, okay? But I went through all this time, and I either dated drug dealers or drug addicts, and finally we get to the stages of cocaine. And of course, for me, I mean, I was a mathematics major, so I had a scientific background. Hell, I thought cutting coke was fun, y'all. I was using my chemistry, you know. I'd be in there cutting coke and shit, and cooking it up was great, you know. I never thought anything wrong about that I was doing anything wrong. You know, because they had all told me that cocaine was non-addictive. But it did. When I was using, they said it was non-addictive, okay? And I'm thinking, oh, honey, I'm really smart. I know how to cut it. I know how to cook it. I'm really great at this shit, okay? Anyway, I'm going along, and in 1985, I met this young man. Another drug addict. Didn't know that he was, because he didn't know that I was. I was keeping it real good. You see, because, yeah, I was still functioning real well, if you want to call it functioning. You see, I had a car. I don't know whose Social Security number I had on the contract, but I had a car, okay? I had a job. I had an apartment. Of course, I was threatening eviction the first day I came to my meeting, okay? My lights were always getting cut off. I was always getting something repossessed, a car or a stereo. I mean, my life was totally unmanageable. But I never once associated that unmanageability to my drug and drinking. I never did. I just never thought they existed. You know, my whole thing was when people would tell me, girl, you drink too much, you get high too much. If you had my problems, you'd do the same thing, you know? So it never quite dawned on me how the two were related until I got to these rooms. So I got this boyfriend, and he's a little bit further along in his addiction than I am, because I still had a car, y'all remember that, right, in the job. He lost his job, he lost his car, he was living in a crack house, and he calls me on the phone and says, he was living in Los Angeles, and he calls me on the phone and says, I got a problem. He just robbed the dope man that night, and they were going to kill him, so he says, I need to come where you are. Now, he didn't know I was using, because he thought I was a good girl. Because every time we'd be together, he said, do you drink? I say, no, I don't drink. And I did. I smoked weed and everything in, but I didn't drink, okay? So he thought I was a good girl. So he didn't know I had a problem. But he called me up and he said, Dot, I've got to get away. I've got to get out of town. Can I come to where you are? And I was living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. I said, sure, come on. I said, what's the problem? He says, well, I got a cocaine addiction. I got a problem with cocaine. My first thought was, shit, I got plenty of that. Come on out of Atlanta. We have a ball. That's exactly what I thought. So he comes to Atlanta, and by the grace of God, he was ready to get help. He knew he had a problem, and he was ready to get help. So he says to me, Dot, we need to find a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And I wanted to know what that was. He said, well, it's a branch of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have a clue what that was, okay? I'm sure somewhere in my life I had heard about AA. If I had, I probably thought it was a motor club or something. You know what I mean? So he gets to Atlanta, and he wants to get sober. So I look in the phone book, and like the good little girlfriend I was with a great caretaker, I found the number for Cocaine Anonymous. I called it, and they said, okay, you need to come to a meeting tonight. I remember this real well. I got dressed up, heels and everything, y'all, okay? And I take him to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, all right? Now, I get there. Now, in Atlanta at this time, Cocaine Anonymous was brand new coming up, okay? We didn't have many meetings going on, and we usually met somewhere in an AA clubhouse or something. But I remember the first meeting I went to. Weird. I walk in the door, and I got all these signs all over the wall, but I didn't have a clue as to what they meant. I'm thinking, these people here got to be crazy. You know, they had signs that said things like, in order to keep it, you got to give it away. How the hell do you do that, you know? There was one sign, I'll never forget this one. There was one sign that said, the elevator to sobriety is broken. You gotta take the steps. Y'all, I looked all over that building for an elevator. Okay. Didn't find one. Didn't I have a clue what that meant, okay? So I go in, I sit down. Now the funny part about it was that I go in, I sit down with the meeting, and my boyfriend and I are the only black people that told me, right? So I'm thinking, oh well. I go in anyway, so we go in and they start the meeting, and I'm sitting there listening, and I heard something being said that night that kind of like made me think. You know, I heard people sharing, okay? They were sharing their pain. They were sharing their experiences, okay? I'm saying, I feel like that, but I ain't no cocaine addict, so it ain't me, you know? And for the next 90 days, I went around not identifying with what was being said, but comparing my addiction to theirs, you know? Of course, everybody's story was always better than mine. There was one guy who came in, he said he shot up in the jugular veins. I knew I wasn't no cocaine addict then, y'all, okay? But I heard some good things being said that night, okay? They said things like, I remember the one thing I heard that night. Well, first of all, they were talking about step two. And guests came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I'm thinking, they needed, everybody in the room needed to be restored, because they were crazy, y'all. They would get up on this podium, they'd tell all these bad things they'd done in their lives, you know what I mean? And people would laugh about it, you know? I'm wondering, these people have got to be crazy. I'd never tell y'all my stuff like that, you know? I heard somebody at a meeting say, pain is mandatory. you're going to stay around these rooms, you're going to have to get through some pain. But what they told me was misery was optional. They said pain was mandatory, misery was optional. And y'all, for this addict, at that point in my life, misery was not an option for me. You see, I had been miserable most of my life. Now, there was one point in my life when the drugs and the alcohol made me feel better. I could drink them and forget the shit and go on about my business, okay? But somewhere down the line, y'all, you know, I stopped using the drugs and they started using me, you know. And the pain didn't go away no more. I had to do more and more and more to make the pain go away. And I was miserable. You know, I was absolutely positively miserable when I got to these rooms. I had tried on a number of occasions to kill myself because I was tired of being there. You know, I did not know what to do anymore. I was tired of where I was. I didn't think I was good enough to do anything. And I couldn't even kill myself. I thought I was really messed up. You know, the big book talks about this incomprehensible demoralization feeling that you get. That's the way I felt every time I woke up after I thought I was dead. I didn't understand how come I couldn't die. So when I got to these rooms, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired and didn't have a clue that it had anything to do with drinking and drugging. You know, I had always assumed that I was one of those people who had been born miserable and was destined to die that way. I just assumed that, okay? So I get to my first meeting and of course the meeting ends, okay? And that was a good part because, first of all, they said, the newcomer is the most important person in this room. Yeah. I thought they meant me. I know y'all told that shit to everybody, you know what I mean? I really thought it was me personally, okay? So that made me feel good. Then at the end of the night, we all got in this big circle and we all held hands, and they said, keep coming back. About that time in my addiction, people had started to stop inviting me back most places. I thought it was an invitation, so I said, wow, I'm coming back here again. So after the meeting was over, we stood around and we talked to people, and a lot of ladies came up and they were hugging me, and they actually hugged me. Now the first thing I thought was these people can't be addicts in the first place because they don't look like addicts. See, my idea of an alcoholic and an addict was somebody at the lowest stairs out there in the streets, you know what I mean? These people were nice and clean and smelling good and smiling, y'all. They were actually smiling, laughing, having a good time. Now again, I judged their outsides by my insides, okay? And I wanted to feel like them, okay? And I didn't. It's because my outside was always in pain. But I was one of these people who had a great facade. I would think you would think I was the happiest person in the world. I'd go to work every day and I'd be this happy-go-lucky person. And people thought Dot had it going on. I go home at night and try to kill myself. I was so miserable. Nobody ever knew this, y'all. I kept all this pain inside. But that feeling of what I'm thinking on the outside and what I'm feeling inside was always there, always there. I remember when I was growing up too, you know, I didn't like who I was and didn't think I was good enough. And I kept seeing people and I said, oh, I want to be like them. Oh, she got pretty hair. Can I be like her? Oh, she's so cute. Oh, I want to be just like her. You know, today, guys, after having been in this program for a while, I no longer want to be you. That's an amazing thing for me, you know? I finally got to the program. Did I get you tired, sweetheart? I guess I didn't, huh? I finally got, okay, first meeting again. They stood in a circle, they held hands, and they said, keep coming back. And I did. Now, I went back for the next 90 days. Every day, I took my boyfriend to a meeting because they told him that. They said, you got to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And they told me, because after the meeting, they were coming and they were talking to me. They said, are you an addict? I said, no. They said, well, I tell you what, Dot. For them to give us 90 days. You come to a meeting 90 days, and in the 90-day period, if you don't like what you're getting, we would gladly refund your misery. Okay? So, to me, I went basically because I felt at home that night. You know, like I say, they're talking about insanity. Now, see, my problem was I knew I was insane because on one of those attempts I had to attempt suicide, I remember hearing the people say, don't tell the police she did it intentionally or they'll take her to the insane asylum. So, yeah, I knew I was crazy. I just thought y'all hadn't found out yet, you know. So I get to these rooms full of these addicts, and they all crazy. Hell, I was right at home, you know what I mean? So I came back, one, because I felt at home, but two, because there was so much love, and they were giving my boyfriend, who admitted he was an addict, so much love and all this good stuff, and I wanted to feel the same thing. So I went back the next night. And for the next 90 days, I went to a meeting every night. However, I go to the meeting, and they'd ask for newcomers, and I'd raise my hand. I said, my name is Dot, and I'm here with him. Somewhere in that 90-day period, I heard my story being told. You see, I didn't think I was an addict because I still had a car and a job, okay? I already knew I was insane, but hell, I've been insane all my life, so I don't think that made me an addict either, you know? So somewhere in the first 90 days, I heard my story being told, and I finally started to admit that my name is Dot, and I am an addict. And it felt so good, y'all. Felt so good. However, the next 90 days, I asked somebody, okay, now I've done 90 days. I said, what next? They said, but do 90 more. I said, okay, why not? So I started going to meetings again every night for, you know, 6 months. Now, but the funny part was, you know, early on in the first 90 days, I go to meetings. Now, we were a brand new young group in Atlanta. I go to meetings and somebody would say, we give out chips and somebody would say, I got 30 days. I look at them and say, they lying. I did not believe anybody could go 30 days without anything. I didn't believe it, you know? I had been there 30 days. I had not had a drink or a drug. I finally started thinking, maybe it's possible. 6 months went by. I still hadn't had a drink or a drug. I had done everything they told me to do because I heard them say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, everything they told me to do, I did. They said, get a sponsor. I got one. I didn't use them, but I got one. They said, get a big book. I bought one. They didn't say read it. They just said get one. You know? So, you know, 6 months into recovery, and all I got is clean. The fellowship kept me sober. In fact, for the next 18 months, the fellowship kept me sober. I had a whole new set of friends. I was doing things I had never done before. You know, I had friends now who said, let's go bowling. Bowling? I never went bowling when I was using, you know what I mean? I never even went to movies. People who did that kind of stuff were dull. But I started doing all these nice things that normal people do again. It was like, wow, this is fun. And the other thing, y'all, I had money in my pocket, okay? You know, I had money. I think I was really feeling good, you know? I hadn't been drinking and drugging. I was feeling wonderful. But I hadn't started to work a program of recovery yet. I only had the fellowship. Now, I did not realize this until later, guys. Don't think I'm that smart, okay? I didn't realize all this stuff until later on in my recovery. The first year and a half I was in these rooms, I did not have any recovery at all. I only had the fellowship. I heard about the steps. And I had attempted to do steps 1, 2, and 3, the best of my ability that I could. But I think I had read them all wrong or something. I wasn't doing them. I remember step 3 says, made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. I really thought it said, made a decision to turn our problems over to the care of God. Because, you know, every time I come into a meeting with a problem, these people would take you and they hug you and they pat you on the back. And they say, turn it over, baby. They say, keep coming back, sweetheart. More will be revealed. They used to piss me off so bad. Y'all know that? I wanted to feel better now. I didn't want to wait to feel better. And they kept saying, keep coming back, baby. It gets better. Keep coming back, baby. It gets better. I kept coming back. Don't know why I kept coming back, because I wanted to be better now. Now, the things that were better again, I had money in my pocket, I was smiling again. I'm thinking, God, this recovery is something. This is really something, y'all, recovery. Didn't have an ounce of it, but I thought it was something, okay? Fellowship was wonderful, okay? About a year and a half into my recovery, I started to get a little bit jittery and a little bit anxious and started wondering, what next, okay? You see, I was still miserable. I mean, I had 3 hours and I felt great. Now you go to a meeting, you go have a coffee afterwards, and for 3 hours I felt wonderful. The other 21 was still screwed up, okay? But them three were real good. I wanted the other 21 hours of my life to feel like those three felt. So one day I went to run up to my sponsor that I never talked to and told them, I want to feel better everywhere. And they said, have you started working the steps? And I'm saying, no, you know. She says, well, you need to start working the steps. I said, okay, but I do it in time. I didn't have to do it now because I'm still not using. So I did not work the steps until about another 6 months started. And the way that happened was I was having a problem with my boyfriend that night. I wanted to have sex and he didn't. And I mean, I was feeling so rejected, y'all. You know, I'm feeling like, okay, he don't love me no more. And I know he don't. I'm crying, y'all. I'm feeling really bad. He probably said he had a headache or something, but I didn't hear that, you know. This addict never heard what everybody else said. You could tell me you had a headache and I swear to God it was me. You could tell me you did something and I swear to God it was my fault. You know, one of them kind of things. So this night he told me he didn't want to have sex and I started crying. And I go call my sponsor on the phone and I'm crying and boohooing, crying real bad. And she said, what's wrong? So I tell her what's wrong. She says, well, have you read the big book? I said, no. She said, well, first of all, baby, you're on a pity pot. And you need to get up off that pity pot. Because if you don't, you're going to find you got a ring around your ass. To this day, y'all. To this day, when I get on the pity pot, I visualize that ring around my ass and I get up real quick, okay? Then she said to me, she says, go read the big book. And I said, what do I read? She says, it doesn't matter, just go read the big book. I'm saying, okay, but what page? She said, doesn't even matter. Just go pick it up and open it, and whatever page you turn to, read it. So I go get it off the shelf and dust it off, because it's real dusty, y'all. I open it up, and sure enough, I just open the book up, and I start to read. And the first 5 lines was the word S-E-X. I thought, my God, you know, what's going on here, you know? Yeah, but the most ironic part, it was on page 69. Y'all got that one, huh? If you don't believe me, go home and read 69 tonight. Right there. Have y'all heard the story about the lady who read the wrong page on 69? Oh, let me tell you about the story. This girl came in and she had been a real promiscuous young lady. She came into the program and she was talking to her sponsor about it. And her sponsor says, sweetheart, you know, we don't tell you how to do with sex, but you go home and you read page 69 and it'll give you some good ideas on how to handle your sexual problem, because she was falling in love with every man in the place. You know what I mean? One of them kind of people. So she went home that night and she was gonna read 69, page 69. But when she got home to read the big book, now keep in mind, this is a lady who's wanna have sex with everybody, okay? And she's having these sexual problems. So she gets home that night and she forgot what page they said to read. So instead of reading page 69, she read page 96, okay? Now let me read for y'all what page 96 says, okay? It says, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Another addict and try again. It says, you are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. Now, can you imagine what that young lady must have thought about that night she went home, you know? But anyway, for me, guys, when I saw sex in a book where I opened it to, it says, you know, this book might have some money to see y'all, you know what I mean? I could not believe that it said sex right there on the page, okay? So that was how I started reading the big book. Curiosity, okay? Now my first time reading it, there were things in there that I thought I had to be selective about. There was a chapter called Two Wives. I didn't read it because I didn't think I was one, okay? There was a chapter called We Agnostics. I didn't read that one either because I wasn't one of them either, you know? So I read it the first time and I saw my mama, I saw my daddy, I saw my brother, I saw my sister, I saw everybody but me. I'd be reading a passage in the big book and I said, my mama acts just like that. Not once did I ever see me in this. So I go on for another few months. And I kept waiting for it to get better because everybody kept telling me it was going to get better. They said it would get better. And I thought they meant the it, you know, the better boyfriend, the more money, the better job. I thought that was the it that was going to get better. I had been in these rooms 3 years, y'all, before I realized that the it they were talking about was me. That I was getting better one day at a time. It's amazing. You know? That I had a lot of problems with this program when I got here, y'all, because I really thought y'all were crazy. You see, I'm back to this, in order to keep it, you got to give it away. How the hell do you do that? I did not know how. The other thing that's always bothered me is people say, don't use no matter what. What is no matter what? Anybody know? I didn't have a clue what no matter what was, you know? But I just didn't use. And I kept coming back. The important messages, I kept coming back. As I kept coming back, I started to hear more. The other thing that had me puzzled, that first night I went to that meeting I told y'all about, they say God about 17 times in the first 5 minutes, right? And after the meeting was over, I asked somebody, what kind of religion is this y'all talking about? And they said, well, we're not a religious program, we are a spiritual program. So my question was, what's the difference in religion and spirituality? You know, what's the difference? I didn't know. I kept asking people this question. Again, 3 years, I go to these AA people who've been there for 35, 40 years. I say, now, can you tell me what the difference between spirituality and religion is? And again, they say, keep coming back, baby. More will be revealed. I figured they didn't know either, right? And then about 3 years into my sobriety, but I call it my sobriety years, y'all, because I wasn't sobriety at all. I was this dry, okay? I heard somebody say what they thought the difference was in a meeting. And what they said was that religion was for those folks who didn't want to go to hell. And spirituality was for those folks who had already been there and didn't want to go back, okay? And that to me was like, I went, wow. You know, went wow. So I finally started to work the steps, guys, as a direct result of pain. Pain for me is a great motivator, okay? I would have it and beat my head up against the wall until I was black and blue and green all over. And I still wouldn't do what they told me to do. But I wasn't using. That's the main thing, guys. I wasn't using. I had found a higher power. I had found one. I had done a lot with this higher power, okay? Because first of all, I had to get rid of one my mama had taught me about and get my own concept of higher power. So I found the higher power, and I really believed with all my heart that second step that he could restore me to sanity. I really believed that. But I never thought he would. You see, because I thought after all this time, I've been doing all these writing things, I know that God is not going to do anything for me, my higher power. The difference between faith, I believe that he can, and trust, I now believe that he will. That was a very important step for me to take, which enabled me to go to the third step. Now I got to the third step and it says we made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. Now, I really didn't have a clue what that meant either, but I thought it meant something like, they say get up in the morning and turn your life and your will over, okay? I didn't know what life and will was. So somebody told me that it was your thoughts and your actions. Now I've been doing a real good job of turning my actions over because I was no longer using drugs. I was no longer ripping you off. I was no longer writing bad checks. My actions hadn't changed because I was still thinking about doing it. You know what I mean? Actions had changed, thoughts hadn't. I was still thinking about ripping you off whenever I could. I still had three bank accounts open so I could still kite checks between whenever I needed to and run out of money because I just didn't understand that my thoughts and my actions were my life and my will. So I'm with my sponsor. I'm having a hard time understanding this third step. I'm with my sponsor, and I said, well, you got to help me with this third step. And they said, okay. The third step says we made a decision to turn our life and our wills over to the care of God. We're sitting there across from the table talking to each other. She took a cup of hot coffee. She says to me, I've just made a decision to pour this cup of hot coffee on your head. Now immediately I started ducking and dodging, right? But she just said, but that's all I made was a decision. I haven't done it yet. All the third step is making a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God. Now, how do you do that? My first question was, well, how do you do that? She said, you simply work steps 4 through 12. I thought, wow, how novel. Never would have dawned on me, you know? So I started to work the steps because, you see, I had gotten a glimpse of serenity. One morning I woke up and the grass was green. There was some dew on it, making it sparkle a little bit. The sun was shining. The birds were chirping outside my window, and I didn't want to kill them, okay? And I looked around and thought, my God, what's going on? That was peaceful. I had never been there before. Never been there before. I had seen it. I had seen serenity in pictures, you know, like Hawaii, for instance, you know, with the blue water, the white sand, and the palm trees. That to me was so serene. I thought, this is what serenity is all about. I had seen it, guys, but I had never felt it. And that first day I got up and woke up and all this was going on in my life, and I felt serenity for the first time. It was only fleeting because it quickly went away, okay. But I called my sponsor and I said to her, what's wrong? Something had to be wrong. It was going too good, right? You see, I can remember many days in my sobriety, in my using days, when I wake up in the morning and things would be going okay. And I look around and say, what's wrong? And if didn't nothing go wrong, I go out and sabotage it and make something happen, okay? But this morning in sobriety, I woke up and said, I feel really good. And I said to her, I want to feel like this the rest of my life. She says, now you got it, baby. Work the steps and I guarantee you it will. Of course, I didn't believe her. You know, yeah, this program is hard to accept. They said, go to meetings, talk to people, and you'll get better. You know? I didn't believe that either. I was a disbeliever. Didn't believe that any of that stuff was going to work on me. But I kept coming back. I came into this room full of people who had lost everything they had, who had been living in the slums, who had been living in ghettos, who had been living in boxcars, living in the streets. And I see them come in one day looking really terrible, and 30 days later, they're looking really good. You see, y'all gave me hope. The message you carried to me was hope, that there was a solution. And I did not have a clue that there was a solution, okay? In fact, I didn't even know I had a problem. Now, whether I had one or not, I was feeling better. Y'all understand? Even though I finally realized that all the drugs I did, you know, I remember people coming in after I got to be sober, and they come to me, of course, it used to be a real big fad in here to say, what's your drug of choice? Y'all remember them days? Anybody ask me, I had to tell them, yours. Because whatever you had when I wanted to get high, I was going to use it if you gave it to me, okay? But see, another dilemma I had when I got here was I really thought I could stop. I was convinced when I got to these rooms that I could stop using, y'all. Convinced, thoroughly convinced. Because I usually stopped when the money ran out. You know what I mean? And I couldn't manipulate you to buy me no more. I usually went home, you know? So I was thoroughly convinced I could stop. I hung around these rooms for a little while, and it became very apparent to me that yes, I could stop. That wasn't my problem. My problem was I couldn't stop starting. That was my biggest problem. I had not learned how to stay stopped. And when I got to these rooms, early on in recovery, early on in the fellowship, let me say that because I hadn't started in recovery, I realized a lot of things, you know, that my problem wasn't stopping. I could stop. I couldn't stop starting. I realized that fact. I realized a lot of things about what you guys were saying, but I wasn't quite sure I was ready to make it all, you know, a part of my life. Because by now, I'm thinking that I'm doing absolutely fantastic. I got money in my pocket, y'all. You know, I know where every penny of it is that ain't there. You know what I mean? I know who I slept with last night. And I can remember if it was good or not. So I thought, this is some great stuff, y'all. This is wonderful stuff here, you know? I thought that was the ultimate in this program. Not drinking and not drugging was the ultimate. I thought that's what I came here to learn. I am so grateful today that I didn't stop right there. So grateful I didn't stop right there. Because today I realized that I'm here for a whole lot more. You see, I didn't know how to live, y'all. My problem wasn't I didn't know how to stop drinking and drugging. I didn't know how to live without it, you know? This program has given me a design for living. It's given me a new way to live. And it all came as a direct result of finding a higher power and working the steps that are outlined on the wall here. Now again, step 3 said we made a decision, and my sponsor told me that it's all the walls of a decision. In order to work the rest of it, I had to go through steps 4 through 12. So I get to step 4, and it says, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That was another one that puzzled me. Fearless? No. I was scared the whole time I was writing one, y'all. You know? Until she told me that if you're scared to write a 4-step, then undoubtedly you haven't got a high power that you believe in yet. So I went back and did another 2nd and 3rd. And this time I did it with a spiritual group. And they asked me questions like, if you woke up in the morning and you call your doctor and he said you had AIDS, what would you do? I didn't know. I thought I would get drunk and live the rest of my life real happy drunk. But I really didn't think that was the right thing. But I started to learn something about trusting God means you don't have to worry what happens. God takes care of me today. If today they call me and say, Doc, you got AIDS and you're going to die in 3 months, okay, Lord, help me to get through it the best way you know how. Thy will, not mine. You know, a few months ago, I was on an airplane. And I was flying, and we had left Austin, headed to Atlanta, and we get up in the air, and the pilot comes on and says, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have just reached our cruising altitude of 37,000 feet. Sit back and relax and enjoy your trip to Atlanta. So, you know, we all, you know, push the seat back, and we're sitting back. You know, within 5 minutes, he comes back on, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we're returning to Austin. We've just lost an engine. Now, my first thought is, well, what airplane am I on? Some got 3, some got 4, but some got 2. I haven't been on one of those that had 2, okay? And we just lost one of them. Now, what do? You're 37,000 miles in the air. You're in a seatbelt in a little bit of seat. What do? You can't jump out, run. Now, all the people around me kept the stewardess very busy. Bring me a double scotch. Bring me a double this, okay? Now, I'm sitting there in my chair thinking, you can't drink, but you got God. I simply said, God, thy will be done. And I sat back and I relaxed. People kept looking at me, ain't you scared? Scared of what? I didn't dare tell them what I had, they didn't have, okay? But I sat there and it didn't bother me because I knew what was going to happen was going to happen. God's will was going to be done in my life that day, whatever it was. Y'all know how amazing that is that I got to worry about that shit no more. You know, it's so amazing, y'all, that I've got a higher power today that I don't have to worry about my life anymore. And it all came as a direct result of working the steps, finding a higher power and working the steps. Let me get back to this step because I finally got to step 4. And I get to step 4, and I finally finish the inventory. I finally go out and find somebody to do it with. I do a 5th step. And I'm thinking, that's it. However, the big book says I got to go home and immediately do 5 and 6, or it's going to be wasted effort. So I went home, and I immediately did 5 and 6. Because by this time, guys, I realized all I had was the fellowship. And I wanted something more than that. I wanted to be free. So I continued to work the steps. I did a 6, a 7, an 8. I wasn't quite sure I was becoming willing to make all the amends I needed to make. But I did ahead and said, okay, Lord, I'm willing whether I meant it or not. Because early on in this room, y'all told me to fake it till I make it. Y'all told me that. And today, sometimes I still do it, but if I fake it long enough, it usually comes around, okay? I finally got to the ninth step. It's the amend step. And I had some things I had done in my life that could not really be made right without injuring somebody else. So I'm thinking, and they were really on my mind real bad. I'm wondering, how do I do this? What do I do about this? And again, a sponsor came in and says, well, Dot, the ninth step isn't all about saying I'm sorry. The ninth step is about change. I didn't realize that. You see, I had to change my behavior. Those people that I couldn't tell I was sorry, I don't do those things anymore today. It's all about change. This whole program is about change. That was the other thing I didn't realize. You know, I heard people early on telling me things like, they would say, the same person will use again. I didn't understand that. But it's true. If I don't change, I'm destined to use again. I can stop drinking and drugging all I want to stop drinking and drugging, but that's all I'm doing. One day down the line somewhere, I'm going to use again. And that was really important for me to hear. I then went into working the rest of the steps. And as a result of having worked the steps, I had a spiritual awakening. It was real funny because when I heard you guys reading that right up front, you know, early on in my sobriety, I heard you guys reading that spiritual experience thing. And I used to wish for a burning bush. I mean, I'd be walking down the street and looking around at all the bushes waiting for the bust the flames, you know. Didn't happen for me like that, y'all. Mine, of course, was of the educational variety. I hung out with y'all long enough, y'all finally convinced me that I was an addict. I didn't even know when I came here, okay? I hung out with y'all long enough. I used to think that if I hung out with y'all, would y'all hair rip off on me by osmosis? Because I didn't want to do no work. You know, work, that's the full-letter word I didn't like. So I hung out with y'all, hoping that what y'all hair would rip off. It didn't. I finally had to get down to it, and I finally had to work the steps as they're listed, in the order that they were listed. And I finally got to step 12, and my sponsor told me when I got there, she says, Dot, when you make the 12 steps and when you work them all, you're going to be awesome. Now, what she didn't tell me was that I ain't awesome, but the feeling that I got today is awesome, y'all. You see, the feelings that I have today, I share them. Today, on the inside and the outside, they match. I no longer feel one way on the outside and dying on the inside. If I'm dying on the outside, you're going to know because I'm crying. And the inside is dying with me. I'm going to find somebody to talk to about my pain, okay? This program is amazing, y'all. Sobriety is wonderful, okay? I finally got through the steps, and I finally realized some other things about me that I had never realized before. The trains had stopped in my head. When I got to these rooms, y'all, my head was like Grand Central Station, letting 5 million people off every 5 minutes, and they all talking at the same time. You know? The train had stopped. I had found peace. The most amazing gift that I got from this program is the peace of mind that I have today. It really is. You know, there on page 84 in the big book, it says, if you are painstaking about this phase of your development, which is right after step 9, after you made all the amends, it says, if you're painstaking about this phase of your development, you're going to find, what does it say? There you go. It says, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. Halfway through. Anybody wonder how far halfway was? I did. Anybody else wonder that? How far is halfway? You know? It says you're going to find a new freedom and a new happiness. Today I have. I remember 1964, I walked around with signs saying, free at last, with Martin Luther King, saying, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. I wasn't free. I was still a slave, y'all. A slave to the drugs, to the alcohol, to the men, to the shortest hot fudge cake. I was still a slave, okay? Y'all may have Charlotte's out here, but Charlotte's is a chain restaurant, the best hot fudge cake in the world, okay? I'm still a slave, y'all. Today, when I tell you, I am free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. You know. I no longer have to get up and chase the drug, y'all. I wake up and I hear the birds chirping and I love the way they sound. I even open my curtains. I let my blinds up. I leave them open all day long. I do. You know, it says, you will comprehend the word serenity and you will know peace. It says, no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you will see how your experience can benefit others. And that's why I'm here tonight, guys. I finally know what they meant by keeping it and giving it away. Here. It makes a lot of sense to me today. I'm trying to see. You see, because I'm here tonight, and I hadn't planned to say this, but if I cry, forgive me. My father is being buried tomorrow. And I had to make a choice whether to come here tonight or to go there for the funeral. It was a real tough decision, guys. But I've been taught that in this program, whenever you ask to do anything, you do it. And I had tried to get a flight out to get me back to Memphis in time for the burial. And I couldn't find one at all. And then I had, in my head, I had been trying to control the situation. I've been figuring out ways to do it. I finally said, God, your will be done, not mine. And I called the next airline and they got me back home in time for the funeral. You see, I had to come here tonight because if it weren't for you people in these rooms, I wouldn't be alive right now. You see, I'd probably be out right now getting drunk all over the place because I never knew how to handle grief. I never knew how to handle anything. On good days, I got high. I was feeling great, I got high. Bad days, I got high too. A vicious circle. I did not know how to feel it, how to handle any feelings, guys. And as a direct result of positive you people in these rooms, I can stand here in front of you tonight and talk to you about recovery and knowing that I've got a father whose past that I love dearly with all my heart. You know, it's amazing how God works in our lives today. When I let go and let God, he puts it all together and does it all right. Whenever I get to that point where I let go and let God, he puts it together. I called every airline that I knew to call. And they always said, well, no, we don't have anything that'll get you back to Memphis before 12 noon tomorrow. And once I let God handle it, I finally called somebody and said, well, it's not on the normal route, but if you leave on the red eye out of Denver, we can get you to Memphis in time. Isn't that amazing? All I did was let go and let God, and he handled it all. So amazing. You know, the steps, the promises that I was talking about have all come true in my life, guys. I have regained all the financial things I lost before I got to these rooms. I look around, I see a friend of mine that I met when I was in Phoenix. You see, I travel for a living today. Like I was talking about, God's been really good to me. He's given me a job that allows me to travel all over the United States. I had gone to Phoenix and stayed in Phoenix for 6 months. I had gone, then went to L.A. and stayed in L.A. for like 2.5 years. And I'd be talking on, I live in Austin, Texas, though. I still live there. But I go to these places and I start talking. I said, my name is Dot Thompson and I'm from Austin, Texas. They say, you live in Phoenix. No, girl, you live in California, right? However, I've learned a lot because I'm able to go to meetings all over the United States, and it's wonderful. And I've been seeing a lot of people here. I mean, I spoke at an Indiana meeting when I was up there, and I saw a lady here from Indiana. I see a friend, all my Phoenix friends are here. And it's wonderful. My California friends are here, you know. It's so wonderful, guys, that I can do this. You see, I have this problem of being alone. You see, today I can be alone, but don't have to be lonely. I can travel to any part of this country I need to travel to, and there's somebody there waiting with open arms to say, come on, Dot, you're at home. All right. You know, sobriety is portable. Yeah, it really is. You can pick it up and take it with you anywhere you want to go. You know? It's really amazing how portable it is. And anywhere you go, guys, don't think because you move somewhere you ain't supposed to go, you know, that God ain't with you. And this program is there. You know, this program is everywhere I've been. I found somebody who's, they may not look like me. I went to Mexico City one time. They didn't look like me, didn't sound like me. I couldn't understand the word they were saying. But I knew I was at home, y'all. You know, you feel the love in these rooms, guys. I feel the love in these rooms from every one of you here. And I know tomorrow when I go to my dad's funeral, y'all will be praying for him. I know this with all my heart. I don't have to even worry about that. And that'll give me the strength to keep going on. You know, I've got a poem that I wrote before I found these rooms. In 1979, I had been to one of my company functions, and I always felt alone at company functions, okay? I always felt alone. I had been to the function, and it was an open bar, so I get there, and there's a quart of Jamie Scotch on the counter, and I tell the bartender, that's mine, put my name on it. I had gotten completely liberated, completely drunk, and by the time the party's over, I'm walking out, and the bar's still sitting there, and I said, I'm taking it with me. He said, okay, I put the top on and took it with me, okay? Now, my car had autopilot. I'm sure it did, because, hell, I would just take it home, and it would take me home every night, no matter how drunk I was, how high I was. It always got home, y'all, you know? So that night, I put it on autopilot and said, okay, I'm going home. However, I was at a party on Peachtree. And in the Peachtree where I was, the first street behind it was the one way going this way. Now the end where I usually went on was the one way going this way. So I get in my car and I'm making a right turn. As I'm making the right turn, I notice it's a one-way sign pointing this way. So I'm going this way. So immediately I panic. And because I was a neighbor, because I was really, really high, I was, you know, you do so much shit, did you know where you are sometimes? You know what I mean? So all the while I was drunk, high. Y'all did where I'm coming from, right? Anyway, I touched the lady's bumper. And she got out of her car, she was screaming, yelling, ranting, and raving, because I had hit her Mercedes, but no damage done. And she goes and she calls the police. Now here I am with an open quart of J&B Scotch in my back seat, smelling like a drunk, knowing I am drunk. I'm scared to death that I'm going to jail. You see, I'm one of those addicts, by the grace of God, who has never been to jail and never had a DUI. God saved me from that, guys. So I know this time I'm gone. I know I'm going to jail because I'm smelling like a drunk and got an open bottle. Anyway, the police come, and they were so upset because she called them, and there was no damage to any car, that she said, he told me, "But ma'am, you're going home." Now, I go back to my car. Now, y'all know what I thought. I beat the system one more time. Y'all know, I didn't go home. Y'all know what I did. I opened a bottle of scotch and started drinking from the bottle, okay? The next thing I remember, I was waking up in my house at 11 o'clock the next morning. I don't have a clue what happened. How I got home, my car was parked in front of my house. My house had been robbed. And that was one of those blackouts that I couldn't even put anything back together on it again. Now, of course, I didn't realize it was a blackout until I got to these rooms. I just thought it was that damn scotch. So I started drinking cognac, okay? Now, it's God in his infinite wisdom. About three weeks passed, I'm still scared. The incident scared me sufficiently, okay? So I sat down, I wrote a poem. I usually share this poem with people when I'm speaking to them about sobriety. Now, it is still approved because I wrote it and I am, okay? I'm going to share my poem with you guys in a few minutes, but I want to talk about some other things right quick before my time is up. Because, you see, I love being sober today. I have stopped fighting everything and everybody. I don't fight the drink or the drug anymore. It has been removed. The desire to do it has been completely removed. For the first 3 years, I was white knuckling it. Well, black knuckling it anyway, okay? You know. I wasn't doing it, but I still wanted to do it. As a direct result of working these steps and finding higher power, the desire to drink or drug is not even there. Sometimes it pops in my head, but it immediately pops out. You know, God has been gracious to me. He's given me a whole new set of people in my life that love me. You know, I grew up with my relatives. You know how, you know, I never showed up on time. Y'all know what I mean? You know, they say, "Doc, can you come home at 3 o'clock today?" And I say, "Okay." I come at 3 o'clock 4 weeks later. You know what I mean? I consequently had no relationship with my family at all. I was by myself and enjoying it. Today is a direct result, y'all. I've got a niece and her fiance have come to hear me speak tonight. Isn't it wonderful when people love you and come back to see you again? Families brought back together again. It never would have been so if it had not been for you guys in these rooms. I'm so grateful that you guys were here for me. I'm real grateful. You see, I told you all the things, the financial things I got back. You know, I got real credit cards with my real name on them in my pocketbook now, y'all. I really do. I no longer do white. I got one bank account. That's all I got. I pay my bills on time. I never knew that. When I was using, y'all, nobody I knew paid their bills on time. To my world, the big book talks about it. In my world, that was normal. I thought that was normal. I didn't think people paid their bills on time. Today, I pay my bills on time. All these wonderful things have happened. I know how to live today without drinking, and y'all, it's a wonderful feeling to be able to stand before you and tell you this, you know. The newcomers in here, if you don't hear anything else, but remember to keep coming back. Remember that. If nothing else you do, if you keep coming back, you'll either get so tired of us. I tell you what we will do. We will certainly mess up your drinking and drugging days. I tell y'all that one thing. You go to enough meetings and you go out and drink, you'll be feeling guilty all over the place, you know. It has been wonderful, guys, for you all to have invited me here. Thank the Denver Committee for inviting me. And I tell the world this. I don't know yet if God has opened the gates of heaven and let me in. But I know for a fact, y'all, he's opened the gates of hell and let me out. I'm going to share with you my poem that I wrote that night in 1979, which was 5 years before I found the fellowship and the recovery in Cocaine Anonymous. But I wrote a poem, it was called The Road to Nowhere. And that's exactly where I was headed, guys, down the road to nowhere. It says, the road to nowhere is crowded with people from every land. And it always seems to remind me of a murky pool of quicksand. Cause the further down the road you go, the more you start to sink. You lose your sense of direction. You may even forget how to think. Cause the people going down that road have no reason to use their mind. Cause the crowd on the road to nowhere will surely keep them in line. And if they try to turn around and go back the other way, the crowd on the road to nowhere will surely convince them to stay. Now, I found a secret tunnel. It'll take you out of that crowd. It leads to the road to somewhere. And there you can feel very proud. Now, the road to somewhere is lonely because there are very few people there. But all the people on that road are really going somewhere. They may not know where they're going, but they're sure of what they'll find. They know that the road to somewhere will give them peace of mind. They've found the secret of happiness. You can tell by the look on their face. They got off the road to nowhere, and now they're going someplace. If you just find yourself on that road, the road that's going nowhere, stop. Take a look around. You'll only find losers there. People with good intentions, but never carrying them through. People who make excuses for all the wrong things they do. People who live an entire lifetime full of fear and doubt. people who may never know what happiness is all about. So if you want to be a winner and you need to find peace of mind, get off that road to nowhere and leave that crowd behind. And thank you guys for allowing me to share my recovery.